DeCamp, part one. I'll do a real quick intro. Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to the Green Room. And I want to invite you on in because tonight on our look behind the scenes at the arts, we're going to talk about fantastic literature, science fiction, fantasy. Well, some of the labels may be a little bit arbitrary in our definitions, and we're going to have a lot of fun sailing beyond them all because our guest tonight is L. Sprague DeCamp, a grand master of fantasy. His career has been a long and varied one, and he brings to his fantasy, fantastic, and science fiction writings a degree of research and historical knowledge that is unique and unusual. So if you promise to come back after these words, we'll continue and get started with our interview with L. Sprague DeCamp. Part two.
Oh, no, this is fine.
Three, two, one. L. Sprague DeCamp, I introduced you before our commercial message as a grand master of fantasy. This is not just my own arbitrary adjective I'm throwing in here. Grand master is a designation given only to very few writers, and I'm curious to know who gives it to you in the first place.
Every year, the members of the Science Fiction Writers of America have an annual dinner meeting at which persons whom they wish to honor are given a trophy, a thing made of transparent plastic, and they give one for the best novel and one for the best short story and one for the best artist and so forth, and they also give one for lifetime achievement. And it was about 3 or 4 years ago that they gave me that one for life achievement. And it's sitting on in the family room today.
Those of us who've been fans of your books for lo these many years hardly need to be told you're a grand master at this sort of thing. But in case there be a few out there who might still not know the name of L. Sprague DeCamp, let's refresh their memories with some of your books. Why don't we go back to the beginning with some of your collaborations? In fact, that's my first question. I'd like to know more about your writing before the collaborations and some of the titles that have come down to us since then. Could you condense a little brief profile here of your published works?
Yes, people sometimes ask me how I became a writer, and the answer is very simple. I lost my job. It was in 1938 when I was one of the editors on a trade journal in New York devoted to the unglamorous subjects of oil heating and air conditioning. The boss decided to economize by firing his two most junior editors, so I got it in the neck. And
I suppose it seemed a disaster to you.
Well, not particularly. If you had known this boss, I mean, he was a capitalist straight out of the Daily Wicca. I had sold a few stories and articles to John Campbell, who was then the great editor of Astounding Science Fiction, now called Analog. And I figured that if I spent 5 hours a week on my own time, as I'd been doing in writing, and made a certain sum, if I spent 10 times that much time, I'd make 10 times that much money.
But did it prove to be that easy?
Well, you run into a law of diminishing returns, but nevertheless, I took the plunge into freelancing and found that I could do about as well financially as I had been doing, and furthermore, I could be my own boss, work sitting down, and wear out all my old clothes. So except for the Second World War and a couple of temporary jobs, I've been at it ever since.
And some of the titles that spring to mind, well, I can throw out some. Less Darkness Fall, Incomplete Enchanter. I'm thinking of a number of the novels that you've written that have so many of the historical boundaries involved in them. Some of the ones that spring to your mind, however.
Oh, The Carnelian Cube, and then after the war, Rogue Queen. And my Krishna series, which now have about 7 stories, counting one in press, 7 books, that is, The Queen of Zamba, The Hand of Zayi, and so on.
And the so-called straight historical novels, some of those
titles.
Yes,
I did 5 historical novels, and then also remember that only about half of my total output is fiction. The rest is nonfiction, science, history, biography, and so on.
You've even written a book about the science fiction field, how to break in, the publishers,
yes,
that sort of thing.
The Science Fiction Handbook, mm-hmm, with Catherine. And also a lot about marketing and selling and the nuts and bolts of making a living as a writer, which isn't easy, whatever anyone may tell you.
Now, it's been whispered into my ear that I really should ask you, above all, how it was that you came to predict World War II. Tell me about all of this. There's a book called None But Lucifer, I believe, in which there were certain startling prophecies. Is that correct?
Actually, in the first place, the None But Lucifer was essentially a ghostwriting job on my part. Horace Gold, who later became the editor of Galaxy Science Fiction, wrote it. And John Campbell found it not quite acceptable, but he thought that with a rewrite it could be. And he suggested to Horace that I do the rewriting, with a provision for a division of the money. Horace, I must say, I can't blame him, didn't like that idea much, but half a loaf being better than none, he agreed, and I rewrote.
It's about 1939 now?
Yes. There were several prophecies in it, and they all proved dead wrong. Horace...
so much for prophesizing.
Yes, he prophesied that the fascist regimes in Europe would just collapse and go away without there being any necessity for a war. And, of course, we know that didn't happen. They didn't go away. They had to be pushed.
There are many collaborations with Fletcher Pratt. Could we talk about that a bit? How did the two of you first meet?
Fletcher Pratt ran a naval war game. He made little balsa and wire and pin models of real warships on a scale of 550 feet to the inch, which means that a battleship would be about that long and a destroyer like that.
About a foot.
Yes.
Close to a foot and a half, okay.
That's right. And he used to whittle these things out at his desk while waiting for the next sentence to form. And he had hundreds of these things on shelves in plastic boxes, and every month his friends would gather and would play this naval war game. They'd crawl around on the floor pushing these little models and measuring off distances in knots by means of scales and estimating ranges and writing them down, and then the referees would calculate how many hits ship A had made on ship B and how many points damage were done by, let us say, 3 6-inch hits, and so on. Well, I had my college roommate and I were living in New York, and he, being less shy and inhibited than I, went around to see Pratt. He was an old naval buff, a faithful reader of Jane's Fighting Ships, and then he introduced me to Pratt. Well, Pratt was an established writer at that time. He wrote one of the best one-volume histories of the Civil War called Ordeal by Fire, and Pratt suggested that we collaborate. He had an idea for a series of stories about whose hero gets himself into various mythical environments by the use of symbolic logic. I had just happened to have been studying symbolic logic at the time, and so I said, sure. So we went ahead. The procedure we used was that we would thrash out the plot together, and I'd go home with a bunch of notes and type out a synopsis, and he would approve that, and then I'd type the rough draft, and he would do the final draft. When I have collaborated with a younger writer, I found that it worked best to use the opposite system. That is, in other words, have the younger writer do the first draft and the older writer the final one, because the younger writer is apt to be more facile and more fertile in ideas, and he can work faster, but the older one is more critical and better at catching inconsistencies and infelicities.
Now, what time is this?
Well, Pratt and I collaborated before the war on three of the five Harold Shea stories, and also on the Carnelian Cube. And then after the Second World War, when I went back to writing from service in the Navy, we collaborated again on... we'd already written The Land of Unreason before the war, but we collaborated again on two more Harold Shea stories and on a series of short fantasies called Tales from Gevagen's Bar.
I wanted to emphasize these collaborations because they do point up something that we have come to expect from so many of your books. Some kind of an historical premise, background, context that surrounds the story, and you love to bounce things off of that historical background. You may take a character a la Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee back into Roman times, for example, but he won't be able to function the way we think that he should. Or you will bounce characters off of fantastic situations from, say, the Faerie Queen. This implies a lot of erudition and a lot of historical scholarship. Where does all of that come from?
Oh, we get the books and read them. It's as simple as all that.
Not all writers do their homework like
when,
that.
When Pratt said that he wanted to do a Harold Shea episode laid in the world of the Faerie Queen, I had never read the Faerie Queen, but I got a copy and read it. I must say that I found it pretty tedious for long stretches and didn't have quite the enthusiasm for it that Pratt did.
But yet you make it seem so much fun to the reader.
Well, that's something else again. At that time, before the Second World War, there were two science fiction writers in the country who specialized in humor. And one was myself, and the other was the late Henry Kuttner. Curiously, both Henry and I are rather serious, even solemn fellows in private life. But that's the way it sometimes is with professional humorists.
I was going to say humor is something that I had disgracefully left out as another characteristic of these books. We have fun at the same time as we are educated and entertained. That's a pretty nice package.
Well, I suppose it's simply a matter that I like to write the kind of things which I enjoy reading when other people write them. And that is the kind of thing that I enjoy reading most.
Something I was wondering, too, you mentioned Gavagan's Bar. Did those stories appear roughly contemporaneously with the White Hart series of Arthur C. Clarke? Which comes first there?
Actually, we both series were written at the same time, but at that time, neither one of us knew anything at all about the other's project. I had met Art Clarke once, but that was briefly, and that had been some years previously, and it was a pure coincidence. Actually, I think we had both probably read Dunsany's Jorkins stories, but I'm not aware that Pratt's and my stories were consciously derived from them. Pratt just said, how about a series of barroom tall tales? So off we went.
It's just how you can keep such a firm grip so many times on historical backgrounds and yet still be a master of the tall tale. That is a very diverse kind of talent, and I want to get back after these words to talk with you and your lovely wife about some of the researching that has become necessary in so many of your books, and we'll get back to more with L. Sprague de Camp after these words. Part 2. 3, 2, 1. Well, welcome back to the Green Room, and I'm continuing my discussion with Grand Master Fantasy writer L. Sprague de Camp. We've just been joined by his lovely wife, Catherine. Now, let me get the full name again.
Catherine Crook.
Crook de Camp. Okay, and you work together in collaboration on many, many books, and we have kind of decided beforehand to talk about two specific kinds of works. One is the historical fantasy. I don't know quite what else to call it, Mr. De Camp. It's a fantasy it has a solid historical background, which you have to research, and then the fun and the fantasy kind of rebounds off of that. Last Darkness Fall has been in print now how long,
44
Catherine?
44 years.
44 years. How many printings?
We got married on the proceeds of that book, and we had to hold up our honeymoon for 10 days while Sprague finished the last 50 pages for John Kemp.
So it appeared originally what year?
1939.
And how many books, how much time did you have to spend researching Rome in what, the 5th century?
I didn't keep track of the hours, but I did go through the main sources, both the primary sources like Procopius and Giordani's History of the Goths, and also secondary sources like the Birth of the Middle Ages and such.
Okay, and in doing all of this, you had to do this yourself. You're not taking a college classroom in any of this.
No, I didn't have a bunch of researchers whom I could say, go down to the New York Public Library and look up this and that. Oh, I'll tell you one funny thing that happened. No matter how careful you are, you always slip somewhere. Now, since this story is laid in Rome under the Gothic kings, in order to lend verisimilitude, I had a couple of my Gothic characters exchange words in that language, and which I looked up at the New York Public Library. And after the novel appeared, I got a letter from a professor at Columbia who said he'd enjoyed the story very much, but did I realize that on such and such a page, where my characters were speaking Gothic, I had him use the nominative case where they should have used the vocative.
Well, how disgraceful of you. Well, I would hope that he has learned to keep such mistakes down as low as possible since then. Whether it's A Less Darkness Fall or some of the books, I'm thinking like Bronze God of Rhodes and other things. Catherine, how much involvement now have you had with the research, typically, of these kinds of books?
I would say, on the whole, Sprague does the research. My specialty, I taught English, and my specialty was style, stylistic characteristics, mm-hmm. and I rewrite the books and change and improve, I may say, hopefully, the style. And then some of the sections of the work, I do original work, and he will work over my things.
Incidentally, I want you both to know that in the Green Room some months ago, I interviewed Ava and Paul Badura-Skoda, concert pianist and his wife, a musicologist, who also work in collaboration with each other in their own writings. And it's nice to have another example of a husband and wife who can produce such fine things. In this case, literature.
And besides, we have lived together and shared the same house for 44 years. We're still on more than speaking terms.
All right. And you have even survived the recent book that you have published. It's about Robert E. Howard, and sword and sorcery generally. And the title of that is...
Dark Valley Destiny, The Life of Robert E. Howard.
And the publisher?
Blue Jay Books. And Blue Jay Books is a new company formed by Jim Frankel, who used to work as an editor for Dell. And he's doing a marvelous job. It's a beautiful book, hand-sewn binding and acid-free paper. And we found old pictures in Texan homes and attics that people would get out for us from their albums or just actually from the garage in piles, and he has even managed to reproduce some of those pictures.
Mm-hmm. Mr. DeCamp, I hope in another 100 years another L. Sprague DeCamp will be researching you and will get correct. We'll get it correctly that acid-free paper has been used. What in the world is acid-free paper anyway?
I don't know the details of that technology, but in any case,
in
certain
the
forms of paper manufacture, they use acid.
Well, let future historians figure that one out.
They never get it all out when they wash it.
The point is that paper that is acid-free will last for 150 years, they told me, whereas the usual paper used in books today will mean the books will vanish in 2025.
I'll bet you wish many of the books that you've had to go back and search through in dusty libraries have survived as well as maybe this one will. Huh?
Oh, yeah. So, of course, the worst period is late 19th century when the sulfide process had just come in, and everybody started using it for everything, so that the books printed during that time are apt to be brown, crumbling fragments today. Mm-hmm. Now, two of the best books I ever had to work were 16th century books when I was doing research for the ancient engineers. They were great big things, and one of them, for example, had medieval French on one side and medieval Italian on the other, so when I get stuck with one language, I could use the other as a pony.
The
And they were in excellent condition, but it was all rag paper.
All right, now let's get back to Conan, because Robert E. Howard and Conan are synonymous in the minds of so many folks out there, and I'm dying to know if you can give me a little bit of a preview. I've not read it yet. What we can expect, any new revelations about Robert E. Howard, the man who committed suicide at 30 and yet was such an influence upon succeeding generations.
What?
Who wants to go first here?
Start.
Go ahead, Catherine.
I know some of it, at least. Robert Howard, of course, was the man who brought heroic fantasy to America, and all modern heroic fantasy derives from his Conan stories. Something most people don't know, just the way Tolkien brought modern heroic fantasy to England. And Robert himself was not the kind of man that he depicts in Conan, the womanizing, free man who can bestride the earth and do exactly what he wants. But, as Sprague will tell you, he was quite a different person.
Yes, actually, he was shy, sensitive, moral to the point of prissiness even, rigidly law-abiding, compassionate and sympathetic and bookish, and though he would have denied it, intellectual. Mm-hmm. He didn't attribute any of those qualities to Conan, I assure you.
What is your opinion of Mr. Howard as a historian or a person willing to research historical periods for his stories?
If he had been living in a large city or in a university town where he had access to really good libraries, He might have done a great deal along those lines. As it was, he got a great deal of his background out of the writings of other adventure story writers, especially writers for Adventure Magazine.
Robert Howard lived in a town of 1,500 people just in the middle of Texas, Cross Plains. At the time, a boom was coming in with the oil for the first time, and that meant his town as a boy of 13 to 15, 20. He lived in a town that was raucous with oil well men and ladies of no better than they should be reputation and so forth. And apparently that change in the world, of his world, from agrarian to modern society and the influences that came in with the oil boom had a great influence on Robert Howard himself.
Mr. DeCamp, I know that you personally are very much interested and fascinated by the kind of story that Howard wrote. Is this another extension or indication of your interest in tall tales, generally?
Oh, yes, partly. And I was a fan of Edgar Rice Burroughs's stories of John Carter on Mars back in the 1920s when I was a mere adolescent. And I've always had a weakness for the sword and sorcery type of thing.
I'm trying to share with our readers now, Catherine, something about Mr. DeCamp. He appears and acts as a rather intellectual figure himself, very nattily dressed, a superb goatee, and wonderfully bristling brows. And you just look the epitome of a scholar at NYU or something like this. And yet you do talk about tall tales. You've written stories about Conan. There's a lot of fun in your stories. What kind of contradiction are we dealing with here, Catherine? Let me ask that of you.
That's a heck of a question to ask in public.
Especially when he's here present, this public.
At home, he is quite quiet and serious, and yet he has just the opposite of Isaac Asimov. Isaac booms around and acts like a clown in public and is really serious at home. Sprague manages to be humorous in his stories and yet a scholarly person.
Share us with us, though, would you, a moment in which he does kick up his heels, not on paper, but either in public or private. Oh, that's an unfair question, isn't it?
Well, I'm not myself a Conan type at all. I mean, I'm very domesticated.
We can call Solomon King.
Yes, in fact, I do most of the cooking at home.
Really?
I do. By the time we got married, I couldn't boil water without setting something on fire.
I'll bet a dollar he can't cook a meal, though, without going to the library first and researching the ethnic derivations
You're
of the
right.
Dinner.
He has to do it from cookbooks. But he does a marvelous dinner, and I work for him from early morn to late at night. I do all the business work, and with 100 books, we have a lot of business. In fact, I even have to hire a secretary to help with some of it. And then at night, when I've been on the phone with Los Angeles or some other publishing place or so on, making dates with the fans for new conventions and so on, then I do my original work late at night when all is quiet.
But in addition, as I said, I'm not at all what you'd call an adventurer type. I do have a small collection of them at home, and when a burglar got into the house some years back, I chased him with my samurai sword, but he got away, unfortunately. His head would have looked so pretty over the fireplace.
I'm wondering now if ancient armaments, as well as engineering techniques, I know you're kind of an expert in those as well, is this another interest of yours?
Oh, yes. I'm a minor historian of technology, among other things, and I once wrote a textbook for the Naval ROTC on naval weapons. And I've managed to get around quite a bit the last 50 years.
A textbook for yes. Naval ROTC?
Yes. What? I've also written a textbook on patent law and practice, which has been cited in a U.S. Supreme Court decision.
I was going to ask you, what is the wildest assignment you've ever taken on, but you've given me two already.
And in addition, let's say I've been chased by a hippopotamus in Uganda, I've prospected for uranium by airplane, and I've entertained royalty, and then survived a train wreck on the way home from the party, so you can't say I haven't lived.
Well, forgive me if such a thing has already appeared, but is there going to be an autobiography in the works?
I've written one, but Catherine doesn't like it. She says it bogs down the fourth chapter.
Tell me more.
Well, it's not true that I don't like it, but I told him that I wouldn't work on it anymore unless he let himself go and told all when it came to important things like he proposed to me, which is really a very funny story. Sprague said, oh, it's too personal. I don't think I'll do that. I said, nope, you've got to tell all or people won't be interested.
Well, or don't forget, other people are going to come along and be doing it anyway, so you might as well get your 2 cents in.
I'd do it if he didn't.
Well, there is that argument. I'll give it serious consideration.
Now, I have been warned to ask you about the purple pterodactyls. Is this correct? What in the world are we talking about?
That is a series of short fantasies which I wrote a few years ago and which have been published in hard and soft covers. I live on what is called the Philadelphia Main Line. In other words, the old four-track line from Philadelphia to Chicago. And
the old track, well-to-do people who settled there.
Yes. And
we're the beatniks of Philadelphia.
You might say, well, yes, you know, at a New Year's Eve party one time, I heard one mainliner say, no, you know, I met a couple of Democrats recently. They turned out to be quite nice people.
Well, wait a minute. What does this have to do with purple pterodactyls?
Well, at any rate, my chief character in it is based partly on myself and partly on a banker friend of ours. And he is a mainline banker and a fairly conservative chap, but nevertheless, he has an attraction for the supernatural. It sort of settles in with him. And the result is his name is Willie Newberry, short for Woodrow Wilson Newberry. And he's always getting involved in quite without intending. For example, his boss, the president of the bank, sends him down to Atlanta to look into the business affairs of a man who wants to borrow $500,000 to expand his ornamental wrought iron work business. Well, the story ends up with Willie being chased through tunnels under Stone Mountain by a mob of infuriated gnomes with sledgehammers and things like that.
I would have extrapolated that right away. I can't wait to see how those connections are made. Before we run out of time, incidentally, Catherine, I understand that you have published some children's books on your own. Children's science fiction, you call them?
My idea is to catch them young and get them
they'll
want Sprague stories later.
I love it. Yeah.
So I've done two books. One's called Creatures of the Cosmos, A Child and an Animal. Of science fiction quality, you know, from another world or something. And the other book is Tales Beyond Time. And then we did another one together called 3,000 Years of Fantasy in Science Fiction. That's the anthologies of last
year. Now, I remember something about 25 years ago, the Winston series for young readers of science fiction. What is your target age group with these books?
Oh, these were for preteens, 10 to 12.
That's a very good idea. All right. I want to thank both of you so much. Any parting shots from anyone about new works to come or general attitudes about your work?
Let's see. What shall we say, darling?
Well,
he's knitting his brows, folks.
We have several books either just out or coming out very soon. We have a novel, The Bones of Zora, which is the story of the first paleontological fossil hunt on...
We've got about 1 minute left.
On my imaginary planet, Krishna. And I went fossil hunting with a Smithsonian scientist to get the background for it.
I'd love to know where you researched Krishna, incidentally.
Down in Texas, of course. Now,
of course.
Yes. And we have the Knights of Zinjiban, another Krishna story that completes the problems of the first. And they're both, one's in press and the other, no, one is out and one's in press.
One's with the agent. And, well... Let's see, what else have we got coming up?
Your three historicals are coming.
Yes, a reprinting some of my 5 historical novels. The Dragon of the Ishtar Gate has already come out, and The Bronze God of Rhodes is due out. presently.
Elephant for Aristotle, too.
Yeah.
And alas, I'm going to have to break in. Such a massive body of work. Nothing incomplete about this enchanter, I'll tell you that. L. Sprague de Camp, his lovely wife, Catherine Crook de Camp, and I've had such a great time talking with all of you. And thanks for so many hours of enjoyment, too, on the printed page, as well as just talking with you here.
Well, that's very kind of you, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is John Tibbetts in the Green Room tonight here on KXTR. Tune in again next week, will you? Because it's always a lot of surprises here when we talk about the arts in our town. See you then.